Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Today is the 80th anniversary of the last major RAF raid on the German city of Aachen. And there's only one man to have back to discuss that, and that is the fabulous Dr. Philip Blood. So about a year ago, we had Phil on to discuss the many bombings of Aachen, and you should go back and check out that very long episode, because we do cover some of the same ground, but we have a slightly different focus, because Phil has a new book coming out, and we're going to tell you all about that in just a second, because I have to thank our fabulous sponsors at the Pima Air and Space Museum for their continued support. It's getting into springtime. They've got incredible things coming up. So please do head over to www.pimaair.org to check out all the events and the things they've got lined up in the summer and the continuing build that they have going on for the Tucson Military Vehicle Museum. So back to Phil, because his new book, War Comes to Aachen, The Nazis, Churchill, and the Stalingrad of the West, is due out on the 26th of September from Hearst. And we're going to be looking at one bit of that. So our last podcast, a lot of that goes into the book, but we're going to be looking at the raid that took place 80 years ago tonight. And that's the one that's been described as the 7-minute raid, or if you're in Aachen, 7 minutes in hell. So we discuss a lot. And I have to say, be warned, we're going to be discussing a lot of things about war, operational and organizational genocide. It's a lot. So please go in with that. It's a fascinating conversation and a slightly different look at how we perceive and understand the RAF's strategic bombing campaign against Germany. Phil, thank you for coming back. The Aachen book is complete. So we're going to be delving into a bit more of Aachen's history. But tell us, the book is where and when do we get to see it?
Well, it's a pleasure to see you again. And as you can see, I'm calling from London, or London calling, you know, the old clash. And so the surroundings are not salubrious. But anyway, you know, I'm sure we can live with it. The book was done and dusted, from my perspective, on the 28th of February. I started just literally writing in December. And I wrote the last lines on the 28th, and I handed it to the publisher that evening. The target was the 1st of March. If I could get it into the 1st of March, then we were on target, maybe, I'm not going to promise, for the 80th anniversary of Aachen being occupied by the US Army in October 1944. And also, with, like today, we're talking about the 80th anniversary of one of the raids. This is all the time period when most of the activities going on of an interest to the people on the 80th anniversary and the follow-up from D-Day. And the book apparently went to copy editing. Somebody you know, Steve, who does maps and who did the pictures for our talks when we did hedge hopping, he's produced the mats for the book.
Fair.
And my other half, Bettina, has put together a destruction map of the city from 1947. And that's going in. And I believe, well, the last conversation I had with the publisher, they'll be in colour plates.
Brilliant.
Because they're quite impressive. So all in all, it's looking very good. I'm meeting with the publisher next week. The book's due in September 2024. And so far as I can see, we're on target. I kind of read it. I read the manuscript the other day and I thought, wow, Mr. Typo. There's going to be a ton of copy editing. But I had no choice. You got no choice. You can't be, you know, if you've got running to a deadline, you're just going to get it done. And so, yeah, there we are.
So the book's called War Comes to Aachen, isn't it?
It's called War Comes to Aachen, and it's about the Nazis, Winston Churchill, and the Stalingrad in the West. I'm not going to go on why the Stalingrad in the West is important, but it's in there. It's a story of total war and how it impacts on a city from 1900 to 1965, which is basically when Winston Churchill dies. I've tried to make it as personal as possible in the sense of drawing on stories from people in the community and lives of people in the community. But I've also included an enormous amount of archives. And of course, I think I said this before, there's probably more information archivally in Britain and America than there is in Germany for the whole of the city of Aachen. And that's a function of the city being captured in October 1944 and the surviving archives, which weren't burnt or taken to the salt mines in Siegen by the Germans when they took Charlemagne's relics out and put them in the salt mines in packing cases. Many of those files survived. But if you go to Aachen's records, there's a huge dearth, big gap right in the middle. And I luckily found them in America and the National Archives. The National Archives got them because the US Army gave the papers to the Foreign Office for translation.
Right.
So there you go. So you don't actually get the original copy. You get what survived are mostly translation papers. There are a few, but very rare. They kind of bin them. And then what you see is how the story is then translated again. So they've translated it from German to English. And then along come a whole load of dudes who we know, like Bomber Harris and Omar Bradley, and they add their little bit of translation, which tells their story. I've tried to put the story back to where it was. It probably won't make me popular, especially as one of the leading characters I have quoted in the book and cited considerably is Slam Marshall. You know, everybody's favourite. Nobody, American soldiers don't shoot anybody. And it might be a shock for people that those kind of characters are coming in and being used to describe the history.
Right.
So it's total war with a little bit of postmodern historical analysis, huge critical analysis theme running all the way through on how to engage with the records and look behind what's actually being written.
So the last time we spoke about Aachen, for which, if you want to go catch up with that, which is probably a good thing to do before we have this chat, links in the description below and all that good stuff, that sort of makes up just a chapter or two, you said, of the book as well, doesn't it? So it's a much broader thing than what we're going to be talking about today and what we talked about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was 100 and, well, it depends how you gauge them. And even to the very end, I found another raid, which I hadn't realised had happened, but which was only disclosed as a, what do you call it, a diversionary raid on Aachen with 16 bombers, which happened while there was a major raid going on Munich, while at the same time another crew was flying over and got shot down and landed in Aachen. So there's that kind of confusion in the records, especially from the American war diaries. I kind of missed the importance of that raid, and now that's been drilled back in. It's only small. It's only a couple of paragraphs in the book, but it's enough to show the continuation of damage and destruction. I selected the 1943 raid, which we talked about before, as a single one-off chapter, because I thought with maybe 175 air raids on a city, you've got to pick one. And it could have been the one that we're going to talk today, which is in the book, but which it's the coup de grace raid on the city from the bombing perspective. But on the other hand, the fire raid was much more impactful because it severed the city from its pre-1939 past, if you imagine.
Yep.
If you can imagine that. I've done it in stages. So you've got the end of the pre-1939 city, which happens in 1943. Then you have the death of the city in 1944. And then you have what happens afterwards.
Okay, so usual things when we have our chats. Ladies and gentlemen, trigger warnings. There's going to be stuff discussed. The G word will come up. So, you know, brace yourselves, ladies and gentlemen. Buckle up, because here we go. So, as you said, we talked about the 1943 raid in depth and a lot of the things around it, especially terminology, genocidal intent, things like that. In this 1944 raid, so when this goes out on the 11th of April, it's the 80th anniversary of that raid happening. So what's the background to it? What's been happening in Aachen, and, you know, why? I guess this is one of the big questions that's always worth asking is, why Aachen? Why at this point? Because it's, as you said before, it's a shell of itself.
I'm not letting any secrets from the book out by saying, basically, after the July raid, Bomber Command seemed to spend nearly all of its time analysing the raid as having destroyed the city. Okay, so you've got, for like 3 or 4 months, reports from the operational directives and from the operational research guys saying the city's dead. I thought the only way to compare with what the Royal Air Force is saying is actually to try and find as much evidence as possible about what's happening on the ground with the people. And of course, with so many evacuations and so many people not remembering what they actually were doing, a few were, but it's that time period when you're in the post-bombing period where they have impressions of what actually happened, which then get, it's not so much erased, they get smudged. It's like the picture becomes very faded, and some people who thought they were doing one thing then looked in their diaries and said, oh, no, I was actually doing something else and I was in another place. And so there's that post-bombing confusion of people. So I thought the only way I was going to get an accurate picture was to literally go through the industrial files that the British Foreign Office had translated and looked at, which to the average person of military history interest, they're not really very interested in how the Chamber of Commerce is functioning, you know, because it just doesn't mean anything to them. I happen to know, because of all the research I did with the Chamber of Commerce, was to know that the Chamber of Commerce was actually running the city. So you have the Lord Mayor, who's part of the Chamber of Commerce, alongside the President of the Chamber of Commerce, all working together in like a war cabinet for the protection and preservation of the city and to keep it running. So as I started to look through the papers, I was astonished to think that in July 1943, almost a week after the raid, they already had an assessment of the city's capability of restoration and recuperation. And 60% of the businesses which had been hammered were back working in production. In addition to which, there had been a large group of people who were deported, is not the right word, evacuated from the city to places like Saxony in the centre of Germany, not quite in places like Dresden, but in the Lower Saxony areas and Silesia and what have you. And the intention was to give them respite, and I assumed by reading the papers they were actually planning to bring them back. So what you actually see is a city in rapid recovery after the most horrific raid. Now, bearing in mind that Hamburg the next week is getting hammered and all the emergency services have gone to Hamburg, understandably, so the Josef Goebbels caravan buggers off up to Hamburg, and all of the fire brigades and railway volunteers and what have you, they all get reshifted like a massive mobilisation action. But the Chamber of Commerce then says, well, OK, we can sort this one out, and we'll have all our local, we'll put our workers, those who need the most rest, to rebuilding, but only on a short period. So there were house sharing, there was active movement to get businesses running. And a lot of the companies were actually up and running properly come November. So whereas you think this is a dead city a la RAF analysis, actually it's a fully functioning city again, not to the same level as it was before the raid, but to a certain extent it's still playing its part in the German war effort.
So you have this, we'll call it an assumption. They've seen massive damage. They've then reinflicted that level to a greater extent, really, on Hamburg. And there's a confirmation bias going on saying there's no way that they can recover from this. And they turn their view elsewhere. Meanwhile, the city itself, the Chamber of Commerce, everybody is working hard to return the city to a semblance of normality as quickly as possible.
Right. Now, that's a good summary. And then it gets got confusing for me, and it still remains to a certain extent a little bit confusing, because suddenly the Royal Air Force started to bomb Aachen again. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that they do all the way through the war is to bomb on Christmas Day, which in Germany is obviously the 24th. And there's always a raid on the 24th, whether it's one plane, 100 planes, whatever, they bomb on the 24th. And they did catch people in church service and the usual things claimed about the Royal Air Force. What is more surprising was there is then a raid every day, whether they drop a bomb or a flare, one aircraft, 100 aircraft, whatever, between the 1st of January and the 31st of March, 1944. Every day. An aircraft is over Aachen every day. That's not including the Americans that are using Aachen as a rally point, and Bomber Command also using Aachen as a rally point for places like Cologne and Munich. So you've got to a point where the people in the city have had almost every day, even twice a day, the air raid alarms going off. So they're becoming wild. But that's not stopping the city from working. All that is, as far as I can see, the Royal Air Force intimidating the population cheap. You can send one aircraft over, you can irritate the population, and it's cheap. There doesn't seem to be that many of the similar situation happening on Cologne or Duisburg. And so I started to get, and I'm still fairly suspicious, that it's because Aachen is the Catholic centre of West Germany, with its Charlemagne relics and the monastery and the connections to the Pope and its stand against the Führer. I think you've got this situation where I think somebody somewhere is saying, let's disrupt that religiosity of the city. Yeah?
Yeah.
Because they're not actually serving any other purpose than of a cultural attack. Yeah. It's aimed at the psychology of the people, their everyday social life. It's not really doing anything for the industry, apart from presumably keeping the workers up at night and preventing them from getting any sleep. But because the workers are in nice warm bunkers, which couldn't possibly be touched even with a 6,000 ton bomb, they're still going to just carry on having a nice sleep, getting their decent rations and going to work in the morning and not being affected by anything that Harris is doing. So I come to the raid on the 11th of April, and the things that come about this raid that I find very fascinating is you no longer have the kind of aircraft participating like in July 43 with Stirlings and Halifaxes, what have you. The 44 raid is mostly Mosquitoes coming in from Pathfinders and Lancasters being led by a master bomber. And on one hand, it's a really brilliantly covered raid in the archives. I mean, it's so complete. I was astonished. But in a periphery to this, and it's the map that I put on Twitter in lieu of this talk, there is a map of a zone of Aachen, which shows the zoning of the population and how the decision to bomb the city is made. Now, the 11th of April, we have things to consider. One is we're getting into that period of point blank, Operation Point Blank, which is to support the Allied landings and transportation and oil and all those good things that they're going to blow up and support the operations on the ground. The question is, here's the business. What raid is this about?
Right.
So if you read the papers and you go along with it, like, you know, those people who read the US bombing survey and believe every word of it, we would be going down a route where we're just bombing a city to destroy the trains, the railways, the rail yards. And if you look at maps of Aachen, there's this ring of railroads that run all the way around. And only one train at the top comes in, railway line at the top in the north, comes into the near suburbs of the city, which was used for the industries like Velcro and these companies that were working on Junkers contracts. If they were going to hit those, the raid wouldn't take the route that it took. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and here's another clue to why it's not attack on the railroads, is that they boast about these 6,000-pound flame bombs, fire bombs.
So this is, what are those? Because those, yeah, when we think of the big stuff, we think tall boy and things like that. This is a very specific, very nasty weapon, isn't it? So you gave it a fabulous name when we were chatting before. What do they call these things?
Well, the fire bombs, yes. The arson raids. I can't remember what. But can you remember the word?
It something barrel, wasn't it?
Pickle barrels.
Continue. It'll come to me randomly.
Oh, like
probably.
A petrol barrel. You just drop it out the sky and go, and then it blows everything up. Yeah, there you go. So the point of this raid is officially it's to blow up trains, which I assume is part of the Schaeff plan for bombing warfare against railway hubs. And Aachen is a railway hub, as I've explained quite a few times. It's the lines that those lines will take you down to Belgium and France, and it's where the most troop lines would go through. And I'm still astonished that that railway line never really got attacked, which is why the Germans' reserves could get to D-Day. Anyway, never mind. That's a complicated thing that we won't include here. It's like remembering the word for the barrels. Anyway, by the by. So we're bombing a city for the railways, and we know that firebombs don't work against railways. So who are we attacking?
Well, one will have to jump straight to the obvious one. You're attacking the people that are still in the city.
That's right. And the impression I've got is there's three targets. One is the flak. I think there's an element of time for revenge. These people have been shooting down too many of our planes, and we know where they are, and we're going to get them.
Because just on that, so the flak element will come to the city being used as a rally point, because as we discussed last time, it's a reasonably easy place to find when you're heading to that part of Germany. So it has a high flak concentration. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. But also remember, they bring in railway flak guns from Cologne. and the whole defence system is being ran from Cologne. I mean, I don't know if I told you, but last summer I actually went down to the tactical headquarters of the defence area for Aachen Cologne area, and the building has still survived. I took quite a few pictures. You could see where they had the boards up with showing, you know, the Kammhuber line pressing the fighters. And what I learned from that story and looking at the way they ran the operations a little bit closely, I noticed that the Luftwaffe was divorced from Aachen. So here's another thing. You've got bombers coming in saying they're going to bomb this city and for railways, but they're bombing with fire. And you've got the Luftwaffe saying that they're defending the city when they're not. They're not actually that interested in the city. And you think that, first of all, you think that's a surprising comment. But actually, they're interested in engaging with the Royal Air Force in these boxes on another map. And quite often, the city gets lost from the process.
Okay, so they're trying to, are they trying to funnel them into well-defended zones or areas that they know they can control?
I would guess. But the thing is here, the reason why I say this is there's no relationship between the Luftwaffe shooting down a bomber that's hit Aachen and the propaganda press.
Okay.
So when the Aachen newspaper announces that the boys have shot down a B-17 or a Lancaster or Halifax, there's mention. But if Luftwaffe shoot down an aircraft, no mention. And it's almost like the Luftwaffe did, well, perhaps it didn't, but the Luftwaffe doesn't really exist in Aachen. There's no tactical base there. There's no centre of operations apart from the flak batteries and the searchlights. The main concentration is in Cologne. And maybe because of that, there isn't the idea of the Luftwaffe protecting Cologne, Aachen as so much the Luftwaffe protecting the Rhineland. Do you see what I mean? I know it sounds a strange way of looking at it, but it's almost like they're saying, we're up there protecting the Rhineland. What happens to all the cities on the ground? That's a different matter. And I had to get my head around that a little bit, because I assumed when you read and you listen to, what's his name, Hajo, the German night fighter pilot.
Herman.
Hajo Herman. Talking about how they would look at burning cities and become very aggressive and shoot down planes every 5 minutes. I'm not sure they did. He could be right. I'm not going to say that he's lying. It's just that I get a much more different, much more subtle impression that the fighters are in those boxes. They're called up into that box area, which they are to defend and look for fighters, look for bombers. They're being sent up to join the bomber streams and guide the fighters in. They've got the Schrager music, which is to allow them to go underneath a bomber, you know, and shoot from underneath and do all that good stuff. But I'm not sure that they're linked in the way that you can imagine the Royal Air Force in the Battle of Britain are fighting for, say, Biggin Hill.
Right.
Or to defend London. Do you see what I mean? I know this is a complicated way of saying things, but it's when you find something which is so odd.
Yeah, so it's almost controlled defense, and the boxes are there so that you know what is in that box, and you're trying to divorce that from trying to defend a city which in theory is defending itself through flak. So when you're looking at the night fighter command, they're more concerned about what they can actually bring to the fight, which is these specific areas where they know what is in
it's
them.
Like they're saying that our specialism is to be up in the sky and to shoot them down. Mm-hmm. It's not to be floating around trying to protect the city. And again, I understand that. I found it an interesting concept that you would have night fighter pilots divorced from the target, so that they're actually engaging with the stream as it's flying around. And mm-hmm. And that becomes altogether quite an interesting battlefield, because you suddenly think, actually, as the stream's going around, it's attracting all of these different fighters doing all different kind of manoeuvres and operations. And it's quite an intense mobile battle, yeah, because it's on the move. There's a whole lot going on. And at certain points, at certain trigger points, they, as they enter a box, they're triggering another set of fighters and they're triggering another set of defences. And it's, and that's, I guess, why you don't get any fighters over the cities at certain key points, because that's not their job. And once they've determined where the bomber stream is going, that's even more interesting, because they kind of just go round and say, right, now we're going to get them on the way back. Mm-hmm. What the Lancasters do, which I find interesting, and especially in this raid, is that they flew towards Cologne.
Right, so, okay.
So they're coming past, and all the observers are looking out, because the kids are now all observers as well as gunners and searchlight operators. And they're way, way out to the northwest of the city, like the Tivoli, where the Alemannia can play football. Now, they're out there watching and plotting where the aircraft are coming from. And they see the aircraft and are constantly reporting by land telephone. So you don't get radio communication signal issues. You've got the cables under 3 foot of ground, wrapped in these steel and concrete tubes, so they can communicate. And so they can, as they're watching the aircraft, they're saying, well, the aircraft are taking the course towards Cologne. Well, actually, the aircraft then suddenly bank round and come back through the southeast area of the city, aiming towards Beveroo. Now, what interests me is they actually land bombs directly with Christmas trees. You know, the Germans call them the flares, Christmas trees. They actually have flares, Christmas trees, coming down on the flak positions, and they're bombing the flak. One flak gunner managed to get one Lancaster down, but the bombs actually ran through several of the batteries, killing a couple of the boys. We might talk about what the reaction to that afterwards. But then the bombing really let loose, and suddenly it became quite horrendous, because the stream, and I find it very difficult to imagine this, but the stream is so efficient, it bombs the city in 7 minutes. So they're in and they're gone.
How,
it's about seven to 12 minutes. In raw RAF records, they call it the 7 minute raid.
How many aircraft are on the raid?
I believe there's 420.
So 420.
I need to double check that. Yeah.
So a large. This is not a small raid, and yes, it is concentrated within an incredibly short period of time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Noble Franklin says they missed the point, and they had to go round and go through it again. And they managed to stay within the stream of getting through, even though they've got to go round, and they bombed on target. And that was one of the few raids that he could actually remember in a bit of detail, so I could have carried it. What interested me was the master bomber was on top of it all the time, and he made sure that the bombing kept to the pattern. And according to all of the reports, the four corners where they dropped, using oboe as their guiding mechanism, were all deadly accurate. Bennett was going on about what a brilliant operation it was. And they basically cut a swathe right through the centre of Aachen, burning and destroying as much as possible. I think a couple of bombs did land on the railway line by chance. But mostly it went right the way through. Now, in Aachen, the memory is that raid was the most destructive. And I actually think that's an impression, because the city had been scorched and arsoned the year before. So a lot of the buildings are already dodgy. What's coming now is this, like, huge hammer blow. What's fascinating is the British tell this story, that the Royal Air Force tell this story, that they've done this mega raid on the railways, and the railways are not working anymore, which but basically wasn't true. The railways were working within 24 hours.
This goes to, again, the perception conversation we were having before, isn't it? It's, we've done this thing, it looks terrible. The photographs that would have come back the next day would have looked quite horrendous. But then attention switches to somewhere else, so you have a confirmation bias that the railways are not working, but you're not therefore maintaining the pressure because you can't, because you have other things to do.
Well, I guess one of the problems, see, I think it's, you know, the more you look at transportation and Point Blank, and it's all ill-conceived because, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit because we were going to talk about maps, so I'm going to talk about them now.
Spoilers, Phil, spoilers.
The topographical departments for the War Office were drawing such incredible maps for the bombers. So, I put the one map up last week, which just shows the zonal areas and showing the build-up area where the most concentration of civilians are. But if you look at all of the maps that they're doing, you have to imagine that they're making these base drawings of the topography of places like Aachen and Hamburg and other places, then putting it on tracing paper, you know, they will trace around, and then they will overlay that onto maps for bombing directions. So what you've actually got is a GIS system, a geographical information system, a very rudimentary one, but one that works because it shows layers of information and the targeting. Now, all the targeting for the 11th of April raid is for civilians, and all the language of the raid is for trains. Now, when certain countries do that and say, we're not doing that, and then go and murder lots of people, we call it genocide. Now we have a problem here. So the question is, how intentional is this? How deeply criminal is this? Because if you're saying one thing and doing another, there's clearly something going on there, isn't there? I mean, you're not just disguising what you're doing, but you're actually putting in weapons which you wouldn't use for the job that you're trying to use. Mm-hmm. And that the master bomber crews and the lead men, they're aiming for a specific target, and the specific target happens to be right in the centre of Aachen. Then you find the maps, and you look at the maps, as we've said, and they're all showing certain targets. And it's either civilians, it's transport, or industry. And so far, nearly all the bombing after 1942 has been not transport, it's been civilians. And we're still doing civilians.
Because I'm looking at your picture now, and I'll put it up on the video. It is quite clearly defined. You have the railways and the 1, 2, 3 sort of five stations marked, and then just loads and loads of, as they put it, inner town fully built up, residential fully built up, and that's kind of it. So there's, if the targeting is of those built up areas and not the bits that are further out, which are quite less densely populated, then yes, that is a I don't want to say troublesome, because it's not. It's a direct obscuring of what the motive is, if you're saying railway but not going anywhere near them.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So then let's just move forward a bit. So we know that Normandy was supposed to happen in May and the weather was troublesome and everything. So there was a series of raids. One was on the 24th of May, which was a double raid. So one part of the raid went for Rota Erda, which is the industrial district of Aachen, mm-hmm. and a small railway station there, but a massive marshalling yards. And the other raid was to go to the Westbahnhof and the Hauptbahnhof and the main railways, which was going down to Normandy. So if they'd have done what they were supposed to do, those two railways hubs there would have been cut for a short period, and then 7 days later they would be running again. If that's the way things worked with the Germans, they could turn around the bombing damage in 7 days, but you would have had 7 days of possibly interrupted service in from the Aachen hub. And they did hit the targets quite well, but they kind of overshot on one of them. And it was an incredibly complicated raid. I mean, you got two sets of aircraft coming in, 260 aircraft roughly on each coming in at roughly the same time to take out two railway hubs over the same city, where the division between the two is maybe 3.6 kilometres. That's quite interesting.
Which isn't far off what the lateral distance of a bomber stream would be when you have three groups of aircraft going out. Yeah.
So you do a good job. Mm. But the I forgot what they call it now, when the bomb's slightly missed, and they didn't cause as much damage as they should have done. So they went back now, and unfortunately on that raid, a lot of aircraft were shot down. Unusual numbers of aircraft shot down. I think we're into the 9% kind of calculations. One of those that suffered most was one of the Polish squadrons. I think, can't remember which number it was. But there's a picture of them climbing into their aircraft just before the attack. So 3 days later, Bomber Command comes back to take out Rota Erda, and doesn't just take out the railway line and the marshalling yards, it actually demolishes as much as that as you can imagine for the whole area. And we're using high explosives, and they completely and utterly turn the whole area into wasteland and killed several hundred people. Now, that raid was obviously devastating. They were over in about 5 minutes. There was very little that the Aachener could do. The defences were already shattered from the 24th. That raid is the last big Royal Air Force raid, and to a certain extent causes the damage, which basically the Chamber of Commerce says, well, it's going to take some time. It's going to take till September before the city's functional again. So they'd put a 5 to 6 month time limit on the damage that had been caused. So we've had the 11th of April, which has caused no end of damage to civilians. And of course, it was a political victory in a sense for the Nazis, because they used it to rally the city against the Allies. And they kept using that to rally the people as an example of how the Allies were out to destroy the German people and German culture and German society. You had the raid on the 24th, which was in line with Point Blank. So the first one was probably not really Point Blank. It was just Harris doing his thing. The 24th was meant to be Point Blank, but they were kind of missed. And then the 27th, the third one, was Point Blank, and that did what it was supposed to do. And so you're looking now at questions beyond what the operations, and you're starting looking at, you know, historical context and thinking about things, how things work. And for me, I'm beginning to consider a concept of operational genocide, where you're factoring in into normal military operations a genocidal intent. Mm-hmm. Now, the crews, they don't know, and they probably don't understand until sometime later. This is the responsibility of the command. They're making the decision of what's going to happen to the city. The crews really are just they're taxi drivers to somebody else's evil. They're not, you know, I don't believe, I mean, obviously there's going to be some people who have great resentment for the Germans, but I don't believe the vast majority of the Royal Air Force crews were into just smashing old people, women and children. I think that is one of the cruelties of what's actually happened here. The problem is all the evidence, and there is just tons of it, and it's been out there since 1972. I've been very careful to make sure I understood when this stuff has been available for historians to look at. Mm-hmm. Why there hasn't been a deeper and searching examination of what the bombers have been doing till now. And I'm not saying that I'm at the cutting edge of academic history, but I am kind of using the geographical learning curve from Birds of Prey with the use of geographical information system type maps and the process of how you use geography to plot and destroy people. Here I am now looking at that experience from a different perspective and saying, well, what's the difference? There isn't a lot when you're putting 6,000-pound firebombs, and many of them, on top of a population living in a city. And now, you know, you have to now think that through. Because if you're dropping that much napalm and fire and phosphorus on people, you know it's going to burn through the cellars. So you know you're going to burn the people in the cellars. Mm-hmm. If they don't burn, they're going to be asphyxiated. So the concentration of flame and fire and horror, that has a purpose. Well, it can't be to just destroy the cathedral, although they try. I mean, they hit the rat house, the old town hall, which dates back to the 14th century. They actually burnt the skeleton of the rat house. I hadn't realised. It was propped up. And it was literally propped up with, you know,
scaffolding and things like that.
Scaffolding and massive, great big wood bolsters, like flying buttresses, holding the rat house up. And I believe in 1946, an architect went in and realized that the whole structure, the whole frame of the building had been burnt. And so they actually had to fill it in with cement and steel. So the rat house you're looking at now could easily have just collapsed into a heap of rubble. The fact that it didn't, okay, we're fortunate. It's one of my favourite buildings, why I often take pictures of it. Much of the insides of the cathedral got seriously damaged. So the old medieval walls, which had the paintings of the knights and all, those were completely scorched. And if you look at the main part where the services took place, all the windows, even today you can look up at the fine glass windows, and there's very few survived from the war. We know that the young kids who were on top of the roof were trying to kick the phosphorus bombs off the roof. I mean, there's absolutely no way I would. You've seen that roof. There is no way I would stand on that roof kicking off phosphorus bombs. Those kids were either very brave or very religious and believed everything about, you know, what the Catholic religion was going to promise them in the event of dying for the church. But there's absolutely no way I would do that. And they were up there doing that, kicking off the phosphorus bombs.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's listeners thinking of the name of the verger who was on the top of St. Paul's during the Blitz, sort of putting the incident. Very, very different building. when we were there, I sort of looked up and went, it's an incredibly beautiful cathedral, Aachen Cathedral. I'm not going anywhere near. It's very high up. It's very steep. Yeah. Wendy very kindly cajoled me to go up to the top of the Duomo, and that was pure and utter hell. So to be up there kicking phosphorus bombs off
they
of
were
a building like that.
On the roof. They were outside on the, and I'm just amazed. Yeah. And even now you have to have all the UNESCO scaffolding around it before they even go on the roof. So, you know, so the man in charge of them was a guy called Stefan Buchkramer. And he's very famous in the street, one of the streets near that was completely and utterly totalized, has been named after him. There is a story there.
Yeah. I just wanted to pick you up on that point of operational genocide that you mentioned before. So what we're saying is at High Command, which has gone straight out of my head, at Bomber Command, they are deciding this is the target and this is what we're going to go after. And then as they are producing those orders, they are, to a degree, obfuscating what it is they're going after. So by the time the B-rolls, the B-lists are issued to the squadrons, the B-form, we get to realistic targets, marshalling yards, factories, things like that. But the aiming points themselves are such that they will be causing massive damage to population centres along the way. That's sort of chain of dilution as we get down to what...
It's the navigation points and the aiming points for the pathfinders, and the pathfinders are being told they've got to land on that spot there and that spot there.
And that's where we get the musical parameter and elements of the
musical parameter. I still find that amazing.
Which is funny because I've got the from the IBCC, they have one of the bomb aimers briefings for this raid on the 11th of April. And it says, method across the top, musical parameter, mosquitoes will, I can't read the guy's handwriting. And his handwriting's a lot nicer than mine. So that goes to say something. Mosquitoes will mark the AP with TI red approximately every 2 minutes, starting from Z minus five. Other pathfinders will mark the AP with green TIs. And then main force aircraft should aim at the center of all red TIs visible. Otherwise, the center of the green.
Well, those reports are quite considerable. I find them fascinating because there was actually corrections in them. If you look at the originals, there's been corrections. Mm-hmm. So the final copy wasn't what the original was. Always find that odd when people start playing around with official documents in those wonderful colours back then. Why are they doing that? In many respects, if I'd have had the space, I would have had a chapter on 43 and a chapter on 44 as a comparison of the difference between the two raids. But I also think Dear Reader's going to get very upset with increasing evidence of suggesting that the Royal Air Force is deliberately genocidal. And I'm not saying that the Royal Air Force is deliberately genocidal. I'm saying there is an operational genocide motive, and you have to locate where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. It's not that the crews are to blame, and I've said this repeatedly, it's not the crews that are to blame, it's the command structure. And the problem is there was no oversight. So it's easy to say the air ministry, what was his face, Archibald something, I can't remember his name for a minute, Portal, he would be telling Harris what to do. But we know that every time he instructed Harris to do anything, Harris ignored him. We also know that secretly, over the coffee table, Winston Churchill was giving Harris all the support he required. The thing that I find incredible with what we've seen in these two raids, the subsequent May raids, and then what happens afterwards, and then what goes on into Churchill's memoirs, where he cuts out the raids, where he walks away from the Dresden raid, is I actually found a series of reports which were put before the Cabinet Office in March and April 1945, where all this damage was shown to the members of the cabinet, all the photographs, all the plans, everything, all just presented to the cabinet for cabinet responsibility. That's a statement in itself. Mm. Yeah,
and that goes to that wonderful phrase of command responsibility, isn't it? How high up does it go, and where does the intent come from? So if you've got orders from one side, orders from another, and you can select the ones you want, and to be fair, the overall tactic doesn't adjust massively through the course of Harris's things. It's maximum destruction across the board, isn't it?
Yes, and we know from the people from the think tank in the Foreign Office that they knew exactly how far these raids were not working, and that their reports were more and more suspicious of the way this thing was turning out. So at some point, you know, I mean, in the last one we talked about Schaeff making the comment that what Harris was trying to do couldn't possibly work. I actually think now, looking at the reports that were put through in March, April 45, actually showing the graphical pictures of all the destruction that was imposed on all the cities, going all the way back to Hamburg, including Würzburg, Pforzheim, Aachen, all of these places. It's like a catalog. It's like looking at a management report where every page is the same. Yeah. And you're thinking, you know, when you do a management report, you're looking at all the pages, you think, they haven't done the homework. They haven't done the homework. And you're looking at this lot.
To be fair, Phil, I've written a few of those reports.
I got other people to write them. I never wanted the responsibility. but the idea that they've done the same thing every time, how many times do you need to be told this isn't working? So, yeah, you've done that to whatever, 1,500 cities, 150 cities, and you know, the numbers. At the end, what do you have? You have just a record of wanton destruction. And as historians, we have to think again. And I know it doesn't sound very pleasant because it means, you know, certain history books are going to have to be reconsidered. But I think that's the case. To a certain extent, what's actually happened is we've come to the end of the war. People like Churchill and the main protagonists, including Harris wanted to produce a report. Here's another classic. Harris wanted to produce a report to be published with all the pictures of all the city's destruction. The powers that be said, this isn't a very good idea. And when they actually looked at it, they said, well, you know, Harris is saying this, and we now know it's that. And I thought, well, if there's that shift, that sea change in attitude, why isn't that filtered into the history? And I think probably, and sadly it's the case, they realised what they'd done at the very end and just hoped that it was just going to go away. If you look at all the reconstruction programs by the Foreign Office and British Army of the Rhine and all these organizations that were working, there's this kind of intent that, okay, the RAF have caused this mess, they're now in command, they have to clean it up. So you have Scholtz Douglas in command of the occupation of Germany. And I'm wondering whether somebody secretly just said, well, you caused this, now you clean it up. I saw a file on Friday, which was staggering. The level of work that was going into reconstructing Germany in 1946, you know, the actual idea of reconstruction, was phenomenal. there was as much analysis going into that And let me tell you, it was all about a few things like screws.
So they're going down to literally nuts and bolts of what's required.
Yeah, with all of the, I mean, this one farm in particular was about the restoring the railways so they could be usable, and they were just looking at the how much it was going to take to rebolt the railway lines so the railway lines could be used sufficiently and efficiently. Because all of these bolts were searing because nobody had replaced them because the German war economy had been put to other uses, so these bolts were not available. And the tonnages of bolts that they were expecting to use on a monthly basis were absolutely staggering. and I was just amazed that you had operational research guys 2 years before working out how to destroy a city were now being put to how to reconstruct the economy. And then this wonderful idea came to me. You know, long before there was beaching and the destruction of British railways, there was the Royal Air Force. That should be a book, because all they do is write about the railways. At the end of the war, they're just, everybody's writing about the railways, the Royal Air Force, the Foreign Office.
And
huge revelations.
That's right. Bloody trains, Phil. Bloody trains. Yeah. But so when we look at this sort of chain of events here, and we're getting to this point where you have huge amounts of destruction, the railways themselves stay in pretty decent operation until quite late on, don't they? Due to the effort that goes into to repairing whatever damage is here. When you have a raid on paper a month out from D-Day, as with the original timelines for May, I suppose this is that sort of mental misunderstanding I have with it. Why are you still targeting populations when you are literally about, and I apologize for the use of the word literally, about to invade, and you want to buy yourself as much time as possible? Granted, you don't want to do it too early, because then there's time to rebuild, yada, yada, yada. Is this just down to the desire to kill as many people as possible, because that's probably better than trying to destroy infrastructure?
Well, I mean, the two guys who were at the top of this, one was obviously Bomber Harris, Arthur Harris. The other is Saunderby. Remember, we had the conversation about Saunderby and his fish.
Yeah.
Saunderby, people forget, wrote the foreword to David Irving's book about Dresden. And you look at what's written in that foreword and you look at what's written in Harris's memoirs, you listen to how Harris talks on those Royal Air Force benevolent show programs, you listen to how Bennett talks, you listen to how Leonard Cheshire talk. There is an essence that, you know, and I think Cheshire's probably the most honest of all of them, saying that, yeah, we knew exactly what we were doing. But the thing with Leonard Cheshire, he was a master bomber. So he's going to know what these navigation requirements are. He's going to know what this actually means when you hit that target at that place. I think it's like when you had the discussion about the Norden bombsight, that not all the American air crews had Norden bombsights. I don't think all of the Royal Air Force crews knew exactly what the hell they were bombing, other than that there was a target on that box that they had to hit and they had to drop everything in. The people who really know what's going on are a small group. Well, unfortunately, that's common to many militaries that are doing things which are not perhaps legal.
Fair point.
You're always going to find certain things that can happen. Now, obviously, at the end of the Second World War, you've got several things happening. You've got Royal Air Force experts saying, well, it was collateral damage, which of course is the common excuse of the military. You know when there's a problem when the military say there was collateral damage.
Yeah.
It means they don't know what they're doing and they've overkilled. So collateral damage should never be an excuse and should never be a defence. It's like saying that a guy attacked me with a knife and I took out a 12-bore shotgun and blew his head off. No, that's not how it works. In the same context, all of these people, when they come together and they write their memoirs and they write books about what actually happened, and then you read the files, you know you've got a problem. So you've not only got illegal defences to illegal warfare, but you've also got a deliberate use of history to engage the public to believing something that couldn't possibly be true. Now, here, that there's a huge problem with that, because forever people are going to believe that Bomber Command was this and it deserved to have a campaign medal. And, you know, I, for one, think they should, because they were very brave crews. But on the other hand, there's the other aspect of all of this, which is something that was done was outrageously illegal. And you can't say, well, the Nazis were doing that, because that's not a defence either. You can't say, well, the Nazis are killing millions of Jews, so therefore we have to kill millions of Germans. That just doesn't work.
You can't use the tit-for-tat argument when you're trying to assume a moral high ground.
Well, you can't put that before the courts. Yeah. No judge is going to allow that as a defence. You can't say, well, I'm killing Germans because they were killing Jews. Doesn't matter who you are. What there's no, that's just never going to be acceptable. And any democratic legal system is just going to say that's not acceptable. Obviously, you know, extremists, you can say that. But you can see how they bring out various defences, collateral damage, the Germans were as bad, Liverpool, Coventry, Rotterdam, all the same excuses. But then you have to dial it back and you see, well, Bomber Command was already bombing before Rotterdam. Yeah. And they were bombing civilians. they weren't bombing military targets. Bomber Command was bombing civilian sites. And as I said to you before, when William Shearer was in Aachen, he was being bombed by a very inept air force that was stringing bombs everywhere and killed 67 people in 1940. Well, that didn't change. It just got worse and worse and worse. And nobody reined it in. And I think to a certain extent, a lot of it is that the powers that be, people like Clement Attlee maybe and Morrison, they were so involved in their aspect of the war. When they saw the destruction, it was just another picture of destruction. Their mind wasn't attuned to it. When it comes to April 1945 and they see the extent of that destruction, then they say, oh, well, we can't talk about that. And straight away, Churchill's going to say, well, we can't have a campaign medal, because somebody's going to look at that and look at that and say, oi. And it's like, you know, that discussion we had some time ago where the crews were given a Thomas Cook tour for the ground crews. And a lot of those ground crews came away from saying, we didn't know we were doing that. Well, of course you didn't know you were doing that. You were never intended to know you were doing that.
Well, on those crew tours as well, they were taking vast amounts of photographs.
Yes.
And you know, that, you know, it goes back to your point about Harris wanting to collate just the amount of damage that was done. Well, they were photographing most of Europe as well as taking people around and showing them what was happening.
Dan Ellin gave me some very interesting pictures of Aachen, which I'd never seen before, and they were from one of those Cook's tours. But where does it all stop? Because if you go, you don't actually have to just look at German cities. The bombing of French cities and towns and villages to get the Germans out. I mean, you know, the extreme bombing of Caen in 1944 to push the German divisions out. Maybe that was a bit of overkill, okay, but it's closer to the front line. What you're doing in all these bombing raids in Germany, and of course Aachen being where it is, any of the local cities outside of Germany because of the frontier are getting bombed as well, because the bombers forget where they are and drop bombs on these places. I think there has to be, at some point now, we're going to have a reappraisal of what actually this bombing war is about, and how it's impacted on the Western way of war. And I think one of the things that I find very interesting in the way that Aachen and all of these cities were bombed in the Second World War is the fact that it turns up again in Korea, that Winston Churchill wanted to bomb Kenya with the same approach, mm-hmm. and he was stopped because somebody said, we're not doing that again. Of course, in Vietnam, you've got the ArcLight raids and what was it, Linebacker? I can't remember all the names now. There were so many of them.
They reused Linebacker a number of times.
You've got that B-52 bombing raids over Hanoi.
Yeah.
And, you know, what was the comment? Bombing the Vietnamese back into the Stone Age. That in itself is a genocidal statement. You have to think about it, but it is.
That was our old friend LeMay, wasn't it, talking about the Russians. It was reused. Yeah, so it's and his famous quote about the Tokyo Raid. But yeah, so it's I can see where you're taking this, in that the sort of dam has burst with the overkill used in the Second World War, and whereas, as we had the discussions about precision later on, you still are in this point where we can do this, and when the time comes, we will, which is what the Americans have done. Vietnam.
Well, I think elsewhere. What actually happens is on the ground level, you have overkill. And you can see that with ground forces when they're pounding places. I mean, I've said from the very beginning, Putin's aiming his guns, not at the Ukrainians. He's aiming at civilian centres and cities. And that's what he's done from the very beginning and continues to do it. If you go back to Iraq and Afghanistan, we're back to this overkilling bombing scenario with heavy ground forces smashing whole areas and mega fights taking place while civilians are right in the middle. I think we've actually got to a stage where civilians have got to say, oi, we've had enough of you. If you cannot be trusted with your weapons, you can't have them anymore, because you're killing us. You're not killing what you're supposed to be killing with those weapons. Mm-hmm. I think the trajectory of, you know, history where it's been based on the military thinking that they can do whatever they want with impunity has to end. And you can see that has been continuing since the Second World War, on the grounds that, yeah, well, we killed the Nazis, therefore that was a good thing. Well, actually, it was, but you also killed all of these other people, including French people and Dutch and whoever, just to eradicate one enemy, when perhaps it would have been more efficient if you'd used the bomber command to take out German troops on the ground.
And it's going to be interesting, I think, over the next couple of months, whether or not the, I don't want to say debate, but the discussion around numbers of French civilians who are killed during this D-Day campaign, which will be once again mythologized massively, actually comes to the fore, because it is an unknown number of people caught in terrible, terrible places. We can get into a whole rabbit hole of Monty and his grabby hands with heavy bombers, but yeah, there's a lot more to discuss. And then, as we were saying before, on that recent TV show, which they don't terribly mention, Targets of Opportunity, bombing insignificant little towns where there is literally nothing there but people.
Well, I think the problem, you see, this is where collateral damage defense becomes a serious problem, because, yeah, I just remember in that TV series, which I think we're talking about, there's a moment when they refer to the Emden raid.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what wasn't mentioned was a little raid on Easons, which was a target of opportunity, when the bombers couldn't see Emden because of the cloud. So they attacked a town which was listed as a target of opportunity, which nobody really investigates what a target of opportunity means. It just so happened that this target of opportunity had a dairy and a primary school, and they killed 190-odd people, mostly children, for no other purpose than it was listed as a target of opportunity. Now, my comment there is, do you blame the crews or do you blame the people who put target of opportunity on a piece of paper that said to the crews, go there if you don't go there? I blame the people who put the instructions to the crew to make that decision.
Yes, because if you put on that piece of paper, it's a dairy in a school. They're highly...
Nine times out of ten, the guys are not going to bomb it.
Yeah.
I just know American... I know enough American soldiers and servicemen to say, if you say you're going to bomb a primary school and a dairy, they'll say no.
Yeah.
And they will use the F word when they're telling you no. And I think this is where you've got a very... We've got to be careful now about how orders have been written, which nobody has ever really looked at. You know, we're very good at saying, well, you know, you go to the National Archives, there's all this bureaucracy. People write all these stories and books about, you know, the exceptionalism of the Royal Air Force and the United States Air Force and how crap the Germans were and blah, blah, blah. But I think now they have to need to read the details again and say, oi, that guy who's written that order, what is he thinking? And who's instructed him to make those civilians the target? And why? What's the purpose of that? Because if the cabinet, the British cabinet, has already come to the decision with characters like Anthony Eden and Duff Cooper and these types of people saying, this isn't working, at which point do we say, okay, now we have to revise what's been going on and we have to think about what the bombing policy is. And I think those kind of issues need to be re-examined. They're not examined now because nobody's bothered to look at them. I happen to make one chapter of my book specific about this, and it's absolutely nothing to do with bombing Aachen. It's all about the direction of the war that's being taken that's going to lead to the destruction of Aachen.
And you can see the politics of that coming in, because if you change tact, you have people immediately asking questions. Well, why were we doing that? And what have we done? And that's politically inconvenient to have to start answering those questions.
Well, there were religious people, there were philosophers, there were all kinds of people who were saying, this is a bad idea, what we're doing is going to backfire. Now, obviously, it didn't backfire fast enough. But I think as time has gone on, there has been a growing concern with the bombing. It's not that everybody is, you know, it's not there's been a lot of writers, but there's been this, there's an element of discomfort. Nobody could quite put their finger on it when I first started to ask the question. You know, you would say to somebody who was perhaps written something on the Royal Air Force, what do you think about the bombing command? They'd say, oh, well, you know, it's a difficult subject, blah, blah, blah. It's a difficult subject because there's so much paper. Mm. I mean, you know, just for the Aachen files alone, I think we're into over 100, 150 files. Just looking at topographical files and targeting information files for these last 3 days. Okay, I looked at the border regiment for a family friend, and I looked at one or two other items, but there were 100 files, well, 112 files, which are topographical. And they're looking at all kinds of things. And one of the things that I've noticed about this operational genocide is how much those writing the orders refer to demographics. And it's the same demographics that you see being discussed in all the wars ever since the Second World War. So you've got Aachen being looked at demographically, how it's going to be bombed, where the bombing is, who the civilians are, what's their demographics, like the Catholics, the Protestants, the Jewish community, the slave labour, the prisoners of war, blah, 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 blah. The same kind of examination of demographics is taking place in subsequent wars. So you see it with the way Srebrenica was analysed when that was taking place, how the analysis of the population was very central. So here we are, we're in modern war, or as I call it now after 45, postmodern war. We're in a time where everything is demographics. And, you know, a large part of Putin's strategy is demography. The Russian population is declining. He needs Ukraine to bolster the population. He did that with Grozny and elsewhere. Back in 1944-45, Bomber Command is thinking, well, how many people can we tie up in there, and how much destruction can we impose on that, and how many people can we dehouse, and how many people can we kill? Now, it's very interesting that there's always dead in all the numbers. So if the policy was only to dehouse people, you would have thought that they would send a raid in and with a big loud hailer saying, we're coming and we're going to burn you. Get out your houses. You've got half an hour. They don't. They come in and they do as much damage as possible, hoping to catch people exposed. And they are. The raid on the 11th of April is at 23:45. And remember, they've given the impression they're going to Cologne. So the people have gone back to bed.
So would there have been an all clear in Aachen?
Yeah.
Highly likely there would have been, yeah.
Yeah. But it took everybody by surprise, and as I say, it caught them. So you look, then you see how, I know it's kind of long-winded, but we've gone out, we've talked about all this war-making stuff and all of these activities, and you now see when you come back to the raid why the concept of collateral damage is nonsense. It's not a defence because there's no collateral, but it is damage. It's destruction.
And it's purposeful damage and destruction.
Purposeful. Yeah. It is the primary aim. And so we go back to the maps. Now, the topographical department has produced a map, which is somebody has said to them, show the civilian areas zone one. And they've done a little round thing, put a one in there and said, that's zone one and that's the highest concentration of people. Probably wasn't in 1944. Because many of those old medieval buildings, well, not medieval, but 17th century style buildings had literally just collapsed. And the rest probably had brittle bricks, because when a building burns, you get brittle brick because there's no wood and there's no frame holding things together. You point your finger and the whole bloody thing will fall down. So it's quite possible there was an awful lot of people who weren't in that centre. But the intention to bomb people like that, because that centre of the town, that very core, which is, you know, from your memory, is a rat house, the cathedral, and the other church is like a little round bit. And then you've got the wall, which would have been the old original inner wall. That's the inner centre of Aachen and the cultural centre of Aachen, and everything was there. So it wasn't just taking out the population, the civilians, it was also taking out all the culture as well. And that's another game. When you're going into culture war, I know that's a popular word at the moment, you know, term that everybody goes wild about on Twitter. I mean, what Harris is doing is culture war like you've never seen before, because he wants to destroy anything and everything that's Germanic. And this, you know, what was it? I don't want the bones of a British grenadier dying for one moment for all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, okay, he's stealing a term from Bismarck, but there's a deeper issue there. It's not just that you're dehousing the working class people, you're denying them of all their culture. It's Stone Age business. You're back to this Stone Age thing. You're removing civilization, which is in itself a genocidal strategy, and you're breaking the demography of the city, and you're breaking the spine of the city, and you're killing a lot of people. And at the end of that, you've literally done the list of, what is it, the five lists that Dustin Duquesne talks about when he's going on about the genocide, the decisions that behind genocide. Now, as a historian, you're not supposed to take that bit of modernity and plunk it on the past. And I agree with that, except for one thing. I can do that if I believe the orders are contradictory or illegal and were sent with a purpose to disguise. And I think all along now that Harris has been disguising the nature of his campaign.
And we're going to have to come back to discuss that when you've done a bit more research on it.
I'm afraid it's in a chapter of one of the books. It's where he gets demolished by his own people. And what's very interesting is when he writes his memoirs, he makes a comment about, you know, the attitude to Bomber Command. I think he's writing about the people who wrote about his work.
Right.
All right. Mm-hmm. But you have to read the book, sir. I'm not going to tell you what he said, but it struck me as fascinating that they'd got wise to him and they were literally kicking him out the door. And I was saying, yeah, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
I'm really excited for the book. I know very, very little about the Battle for Aachen itself, so I'm looking forward to that. And we need to pop back. To be fair, we'll be here. We got to meet up, have beers and things. We haven't managed that yet, but get over and you can do your wander around the city and drag me around, showing me how the battle played out, because it is.
People are going to find the book very different from what they expected. I'm not going to tell you anything, but the book masks a lot of things, and I'm saying masks. All right.
Well, yeah, I'm just hoping you let me read this one early, because you never let me read the other ones early. Phil, as always, this has been a delight. We will be meeting up for beer shortly. We can discuss that in a minute. But what is the book called, and when is this out?
What Comes to Aachen. And it should be out in September of this year.
Fantastic.
Thank you. And it's been published by Hearst. Mm-hmm. And there's colour pictures in it.
Well, hey. And design god Steve Smith involved as well. Bring it on. There we go. I miss Steve. That's the big, yeah. It was always good fun working with him on history. Anyways, dear listener.
I have to say, Hearst have done a brilliant cover. Mm. And they've actually, I think it's really interesting. They've described the book better than me.
Well,
yeah. Kind of getting worried.
I'm sure they've drawn up all of the fantastic content and distilled it there. So cool. Thank you, Phil.
It was a pleasure. Always good to talk.
I'm sure you can see there's a lot to take in there. And thanks for sticking with us throughout the show, because it's a subject I find fascinating. We tend to have quite a narrow focus when we look at what happened with the bombing campaign, and seeing that sort of flip side of it in Germany is very interesting as well, because without turning things around, we can't really get a full view of it. War Comes to Aachen is out on the 23rd of September from Hearst Publishers, so be sure to get that pre-ordered. You can do that even from our very own Damcaster's bookshop. Link in the description below. All that good stuff. As is all of Phil's socials, which you'll want to follow, because, goodness, there is a lot going on between now and then. So, as always, thank you so much for your continued support. If you'd like to get these episodes early, slightly different edits, but also opportunities to meet some of our guests in our socials, you can become a Damcastier from just £3 a month, plus a bit of VAT. Check that out via the link in our description below, or at patreon.com/thedamcasters. So until next time, thank you so much for listening and joining us for this conversation. Let us know what you think. Send us some feedback. Give us a review. Like and subscribe. All that good stuff. And we'll be back soon. Thanks again. Do take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Bony Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh.
Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.